From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq. The vast majority of them, five brigades, will be deployed to Baghdad.
President Bush announces plans to escalate the war in Iraq and openly rejects calls for withdrawal of troops. We'll go to Iraq to speak with an Army sergeant serving his second tour of duty there, and we'll speak with two peace activists in Najaf and Washington, D.C. Also, over 700 men have been imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay since it opened.
Today is the fifth anniversary of Guantanamo, and not one person has been charged there. And it does not take, as we know in democratic society, it doesn't take 5 years to convict somebody of a crime.
We'll go to Cuba to speak with a former Guantanamo prisoner who's returned to call for the prison's closing. And we'll speak with the brother of one of the detainees who's been held there since 2002. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than a week after the U.S. death toll in Iraq passed 3,000, President Bush has announced plans to escalate the war and send over 20,000 more troops to Iraq. In a primetime address Wednesday, the president called the situation in Iraq unacceptable and said he takes responsibility for past mistakes. But he insisted more troops are needed on the ground.
So America will change our strategy to help the Iraqis carry out their campaign to put down sectarian violence and bring security to the people of Baghdad. This will require increasing American force levels. So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq. The vast majority of them, five brigades, will be deployed to Baghdad.
The troop increase appears to have already begun. ABC News is reporting 90 advanced troops from the 82nd Airborne Division arrived in Baghdad Wednesday. While most of his speech focused on Iraq, President Bush explicitly threatened Iran and Syria. Bush announced he recently ordered the deployment of a second aircraft strike group to the Persian Gulf. He also vowed to seek out and destroy those who are providing material support to U.S. enemies in Iraq. Hours after Bush's speech, U.S. forces raided the Iranian consulate in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil and arrested five employees. Bush's announcement comes despite record levels of opposition to escalating the war. A Gallup poll this week found 61% of Americans oppose sending more troops to Iraq, and a record low of 26% approve of the president's handling of the Iraq war. Recent polls in Iraq also show 7 out of 10 Iraqis want U.S. troops to withdraw within the next year. At least one Republican senator joined calls rejecting the president's plan. Kansas Republican Sam Brownback said he opposes the troop increase because Iraq requires a political rather than a military solution. Brownback said this in Iraq. As the Bush administration sends more troops to Iraq, the British government is reportedly preparing to reduce its force by nearly half. The London Daily Telegraph is reporting today British Prime Minister Tony Blair plans to withdraw 3,000 British troops by the end of May. In other Iraq news, new details have been revealed in the rape of an Iraqi teenager and the murder of her and her mother, father, and sister by U.S. troops in the town of Mahmoudiya. The Associated Press reports the military knew the alleged ringleader in the case had homicidal tendencies and spoke about his desire to kill Iraqis. The suspect, former Private Stephen Green, is accused of raping 14-year-old Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi, then killing her, along with her two parents and her five-year-old sister last March. 3 months earlier, Green told an Army stress team he desired to avenge the death of fellow soldiers and kill Iraqi citizens. Green was prescribed a mood drug and told to get more sleep. He returned to duty the following day. One soldier has already been sentenced to 90 years. Green and four others face charges. In other news, Hamas appeared to break new ground Wednesday over its stance on recognizing Israel. In an interview with the Reuters news agency, exiled Hamas political leader Khaled Mashal said Hamas sees Israel as a reality that exists. Mashal suggested formal recognition of Israel would come if Israel agrees to recognize a Palestinian state.
We today are talking of Arab and Palestinian readiness to accept a state on 1967 borders on the assumption that this will provide an important amount of stability and peace in the region. The question is, is their Israeli, American, and international readiness to admit this Palestinian demand.
In Sudan, President Omar Hassan al-Bashir said Wednesday he agreed to a new two-month ceasefire in Darfur. Rebel groups are also said to have agreed to the temporary truce, but both sides have defied similar efforts in the past. Bashir also repeated his government's rejection of a peacekeeping force led by the UN. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon pledged to address the Darfur crisis at his first overseas trip to this month's African Union summit in Ethiopia.
I'm firmly committed to resolve this issue as soon as possible to prevent further sufferings of innocent people in the Darfur area.
In Ethiopia, exiled former leader Mengistu Haile Mariam was sentenced to life in prison Thursday after an absentee trial that spanned more than a decade. Mengistu was found guilty of killing thousands of people during his 17 years in power beginning in 1974. Mengistu currently lives in Zimbabwe, where government officials say he will not be extradited. In environmental news, the European Union unveiled a new energy policy Wednesday that claims the fight against global warming is a central factor. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso made the announcement in Brussels.
Today, the Commission will call on the European Council to agree to promote a 30% cut in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 for developed countries in international negotiations. But the European Union needs to act now. This is why we propose an European Union commitment now to reduce European Union greenhouse emissions by at least 20% by 2020 as compared to 1990 levels.
Protests are being held around the world today on the fifth year anniversary of the opening of the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay. In Washington, a nonviolent direct action is planned outside the federal court. Meanwhile, in Cuba, one of the first international delegations of former prisoners, families of current prisoners, U.S. lawyers and human rights activists are protesting today in front of the gates of Guantanamo. In Britain, dozens gathered in London to call for the release of Guantanamo prisoners. 10-year-old Anas Albana called for the release of his father, British resident Jamil Albana, and family friend Bashir al-Rawi.
My dad has been away for 4 years, and it has been a very difficult time for all of us. Is there any justice in this world that can help my dad and also Uncle Bashir? My dad is a human, even though he didn't have a British passport. Where is the human rights?
Both Albana and al-Rawi have been held at Guantanamo since 2002. More coverage of the International Day to Shut Down Guantanamo later in the broadcast. In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez was sworn in for a third term Wednesday following his landslide re-election last month. Chavez won with more than 60% of the vote.
I will give up my days and my nights and my entire life to construct Venezuelan socialism. To construct a new political system, a new social system, and a new economic system. I swear in the name of Christ, the greatest socialist in history.
President Chavez unveiled new plans this week to nationalize telephone and electric companies and increase government control over major oil projects. Hours later, Chavez flew to Nicaragua for the inauguration of Daniel Ortega. Tens of thousands of people packed the streets of the capital of Managua, waving the red and black colors of the Sandinista Party. Ortega won re-election in November, 16 years after he was voted out of office following a decade-long U.S. campaign against his government. The Bush administration opposed Ortega's bid to return to office and suggested economic sanctions would follow if he won. Back in the United States, Democrats continue their 100-hour agenda in Congress Wednesday with the passage of a measure to raise the minimum wage. The hourly wage would increase to $7.25 from the current minimum of $5.15. The legislation now goes to the Senate. The White House has opposed the measure and insists any wage increase should be accompanied by a tax cut for business. In media news, the controversial chair of the Broadcasting Board of Governors has announced he's stepping down. Kenneth Tomlinson was forced out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting after it was revealed he improperly tried to promote conservatives in the organization and monitor programs he accused of having a liberal bias. He's also been accused of ethics violations and doling out government contracts and using federal employees for personal business. And finally, this update to a story we've been following. The charity of Microsoft founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda has announced it'll conduct a review to determine whether its investment holdings and policies are compatible with its social mission. The announcement follows a lengthy expose in the Los Angeles Times that revealed the Gates Foundation has invested nearly $9 billion in companies whose practices run counter to the foundation's charitable goals. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our interview with the lead reporter who broke the story, Charles Piller. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As President Bush announced plans last night to escalate the war in Iraq and send over 20,000 more troops, he also threatened direct military action against Iran and Syria. The president announced the deployment of an additional carrier strike group to the region and vowed to seek out and destroy those who are providing material support to U.S. enemies in Iraq.
Succeeding in Iraq also requires defending its territorial integrity and stabilizing the region in the face of extremist challenges. This begins with addressing Iran and Syria. These two regimes are allowing terrorists and insurgents to use their territory to move in and out of Iraq. Iran is providing material support for attacks on American troops. We will disrupt the attacks on our forces. We will interrupt the flow of support from Iran and Syria. And we will seek out and destroy the networks providing advanced weaponry and training to our enemies in Iraq. We are also taking other steps to bolster the security of Iraq and protect American interests in the Middle East. I recently ordered the deployment of an additional carrier strike group to the region. We will expand intelligence sharing and deploy Patriot air defense systems to reassure our friends and allies. We will work with the governments of Turkey and Iraq to help them resolve problems along their border. And we will work with others to prevent Iran from gaining nuclear weapons and dominating the region.
Hours after the president spoke, U.S. forces raided the Iranian consulate in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil. The troops broke into the office, seized documents and computers, and arrested five employees. In Iraq, President Bush said he takes responsibility for past mistakes, but says more troops are needed to pacify Baghdad and other parts of the country.
So America will change our strategy to help the Iraqis carry out their campaign to put down sectarian violence and bring security to the people of Baghdad. This will require increasing American force levels. So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq. The vast majority of them, five brigades, will be deployed to Baghdad. These troops will work alongside Iraqi units and be embedded in their formations. Our troops will have a well-defined mission to help Iraqis clear and secure neighborhoods, to help them protect the local population, and to help ensure that the Iraqi forces left behind are capable of providing the security that Baghdad needs.
The troop increase has already begun. 90 advanced troops from the 82nd Airborne Division arrived in Baghdad Wednesday. During his speech, President Bush openly rejected calls from Democrats on Capitol Hill to begin withdrawing troops.
This new approach comes after consultations with Congress about the different courses we could take in Iraq. Many are concerned that the Iraqis are becoming too dependent on the United States. And therefore, our policy should focus on protecting Iraq's borders and hunting down al-Qaeda. Their solution is to scale back America's efforts in Baghdad or announce the phased withdrawal of our combat forces. We carefully considered these proposals, and we concluded that to step back now would force a collapse of the Iraqi government, tear the country apart, and result in mass killings on an unimaginable scale. Such a scenario would result in our troops being forced to stay in Iraq even longer and confront an enemy that is even more lethal. If we increase our support at this crucial moment and help the Iraqis break the current cycle of violence, we can hasten the day our troops begin coming home.
President Bush, speaking last night, escalating the war in Iraq, and so we go first to Iraq. My next guest, Sergeant Ron Cantu, is an Army sergeant serving a second tour of duty in Iraq right now. He recently signed a petition to Congress known as an Appeal for Redress, calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. The appeal will be delivered to Capitol Hill next week. Sergeant Cantu is a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He started the website forum soldiersvoices.net to give soldiers a forum to speak about the Iraq war. Now joining us on the line from Iraq. It is very brave of you to join us, Sergeant Cantu.
Yeah, well, I'm scared out of my mind right now.
Why are you scared?
Over here. I don't really want to go into that. All I really want to say, because I shouldn't be doing this, all I want to say is right now, American soldiers are dying in a Sunni-Shiite civil war, a sectarian civil war. That's a fact based on my personal observations. Soldiers' hands are tied to defend themselves. Every time a soldier fires his weapon in defense, he has to sign paperwork making sure it was justified. You know, I want to stress that soldiers want to fight, soldiers want to go on the offensive, but everything we're doing here is on the defense. And it's a belief of the soldiers I've talked to that any troop withdrawal here, or any troop increase over here, it's just going to be more sitting ducks, more targets. Everything we're doing is reactive. People go out on patrols, and they make their sitting ducks until somebody strikes first. There was a story relayed to me by somebody I know. Don't want to get it in the same. A soldier was shot in the face, and nobody fired back because they couldn't see where it was coming from. That's what this has come down to, and that's just plain fact. I'm sorry.
Sergeant Cantu, can you explain the appeal for redress that you've signed?
All it is, it's just that one of the rights that soldiers have is a right to communicate unfettered with their elected member of Congress. It's just about a troop withdrawal. I mean, the website, Appeal for Redress website, is pretty straightforward. If anybody's been there, it's very straightforward.
Do you have support in Iraq where you are among your cavalry division?
I'm sorry?
Do you have support in the 1st Cavalry Division for your call for the troops to come home?
A lot of people still aren't even aware of it, the appeal.
Sergeant Cantu, are you there?
Yes. I'm here.
And what are you demanding of the president, of the Congress right now? Sergeant Cantu. Sergeant Cantu, are you there? You're listening to an exclusive live broadcast with Sergeant Ron Cantu. He's one of over 1,000 soldiers who've signed what is called an appeal to redress, which will be delivered on Capitol Hill on Martin Luther King's birthday, calling for the troops to be called home. All of the uniformed endorsers are calling on Congress to bring the troops home. We are turning now to another peace activist joining us now from Washington, D.C., who are calling for President Bush to pull the troops home as well. Leslie Kagan joins us. She is the head of United for Peace and Justice. Your response, both to hearing Sergeant Ron Cantu speaking to us from Iraq, as well as President Bush speaking last night from the library in the White House.
Yes, hi, morning. You know, one level, we're not surprised by what the president said. He has been consistent for more than 4 years now about his commitment to this war. And last night, he just reinforced his commitment to this war by actually escalating our involvement by announcing that he's sending more troops. I think in terms of the brave, very brave people inside the military, including the person who we just spoke to in Iraq, who are speaking out against the war, this shows just how deeply the people of this country, including the people who wear the uniform of the United States military, how deeply people feel in their opposition to what the president has brought to us and to the people of Iraq. This war has to end. It never should have started. It was a war totally based on lies. It has to end. It has to end now. And really, you know, our message goes out not only to the president, but also to Congress. Congress is beginning. Some members of Congress are now beginning to speak up, to make their voices heard. We want to reinforce that. We want the Congress to really speak to the president in terms of explaining what the American people want. In November, you know, on Election Day in November, there was a nationwide mandate, really, on the war. And I don't think the pundits and the analysis, the people do the analysis of the elections, I don't think anybody really understood just how deeply the feeling against the war is in this country until November 7th. And now we have a new Congress. We're calling on Congress to stand up to the president and use their power and use power swiftly. Use it now to end this war and bring all of our troops home.
We're talking to Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. We're going to break, then we'll return, and we'll go back to Iraq to speak with an Iraqi activist in Najaf. Stay with us. By Dalida here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We go now to Najaf. Sami Rasuli is there. He's an Iraqi-American currently living in Najaf. He grew up in Iraq, left in the late 70s, eventually moved to the United States, lived in Minneapolis, where he opened a restaurant serving Middle Eastern cuisine, was a watering hole for people particularly concerned about the war. In November 2004, nearly 30 years after leaving Iraq, Sami returned home to help rebuild his country. He is currently a member of an established the Muslim Peacemakers team in Najaf. Sami, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you respond to President Bush calling for 20,000 more troops? Apparently, this has already begun to be moved into Iraq.
Thank you, Amy, and good to hear your voice and part of your program here in Najaf. Actually, Amy, for the last 4 days, I couldn't get a shower because there is no electricity, there is no heating. So water is so cold in this harsh winter in Iraq, because Iraq has a continental climate that very cold in the winter and very hot in the summer. So I speak to you, as I speak to you, I really stink. And as the increasing prices in the economy, that collapsing stink, and the Iraqi government policy stink, and even the American policy, that so-called surge in Iraq, stink too, because, as you know, and the Iraqis know, and the others, that the occupation is a form of war. So any escalation in this type of war, the resistance gonna escalate too. And I just want to remind you, I remind whoever is listening, that Alberto Fernandez is a senior official in the, I think, Foreign Affairs in Middle East in the State Department. Once he was interviewed by Al Jazeera, and he stated that the American government exercised in their occupation of Iraq and the policies kind of stupidity and arrogance. And I would like to add the ignorance too, because I don't think who is leading in the White House understand the people, the culture, the history of the region. Sending 20,000, as I understand, and the Iraqis see it, it's just a substitute for the losses of the U.S. men and women in uniform who fell either dead or severely injured. If you remember, there were about 160,000 of American men and women when the occupation started. And now, before those 20,000, we have like almost 140,000. Margaret Pickett out of London, the foreign minister, she declined to send any forces, British forces, neither the Australian. So it's the sole job of this occupation to be exercised in Iraq by the U.S. forces, unfortunately. And as we know, how many people got killed, according to Lancet study, about 6,500,000 so far. Iraqis claim it's over a million. That added to the 1.5 million of Iraqi got killed during the sanction, if you remember, when Baker III met Tariq Aziz back in 1991 and warned Tariq and his government, delivering him a letter to the president of Iraq at that time, Saddam Hussein, telling him, if you don't withdraw from Kuwait, we will bring about the country to Stone Age. And now I'm experiencing, unfortunately, the Stone Age. We don't have gasoline, we don't have kerosene to have our families warmed in this winter. And if I understand from the president's statement that he is sending this 20,000 to protect Saudis, Jordanian, and the Egyptians and the Gulf states, who are the allies of the U.S. for the last 30 years and so. So from whom to protect them? From the Iraqi resistance forces? This is another lie add to the White House policymakers, who keeps just sustaining their lies by another lies since the war started. And it seemed to us and others that we forgot what's the reason that the U.S. sent its troops in the first place.
We're talking to Sami Rasuli in Najaf. We also have Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice in Washington, D.C. Leslie Kagan, what are your plans right now, United for Peace and Justice? Just reading a piece in the Washington Post quoting Virginia Congressmember Jim Moran, saying today John Murtha, the Pennsylvania Congressmember most known for his early call for troops to withdraw, will report back to the committee he now heads heads, which is the committee subcommittee on appropriations on defense, reporting back about plans that could attach so many conditions and benchmarks to the funds that it would be all but impossible to spend the money without running afoul of Congress. This is talking about funding for the war. And House Majority Whip James Clyburn from South Carolina is quoted as saying 21,500 troops ought to have 21,500 strings attached to them.
Right. Well, we think it is critical at this moment to put the pressure, obviously to keep the pressure on the Bush administration, but to expand the pressure on the Congress. It is great that some of these members of Congress are now speaking out against the war, but they have a power that none of the rest of us has, and that is they control the money. They control the budget. If the United States Congress was to say no more money for this war, either for the escalation of the war or for maintaining it at the present troop levels, no more money for this war, well, indeed, that would have a profound impact on their ability to carry out the war. So let me just mention two things that are in motion. One is today, all around the country, in at least 500 different places, there are activities, events, protests, vigils, calling on the president to back away from this insane plan to send more troops. That was a very quick turnaround to organize that, and we're doing that with Win Without War, True Majority, a whole bunch of groups, and there's a website, AmericaSaysNo.org, that everyone can go to and find where there's protests in your neighborhood, in your community. And then in just a few weeks, on Saturday, January 27th, people from every corner of the country are gathering here in Washington, where I am right now, to march around the Capitol to deliver our message. It is time to end the war. The people spoke. The voters of this country had their opportunity in November to make their voices heard. Now we're saying to Congress, you need to act on the will of the people of this country. So on Saturday, January 27th, people will be getting on buses and trains and carpools and every other manner of transportation and gathering here in Washington on the Mall between 3rd Street and 7th Street at 11 a.m. in the morning and delivering this message. And on top of that, we're asking people to stay here in Washington for a few more days to do a massive lobby day on Monday, the 29th of January. All of this information is on our website, UnitedForPeace.org. We encourage you to get more information about today's protests and then the humongous, what we believe will be a humongous march on Washington on Saturday, January 27th.
Leslie Kagan, I want to thank you for being with us in Washington, D.C., National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, and Sami Rasuli, founder of the Muslim Peacemakers Team, speaking to us from Najaf. Also earlier, Sergeant Ron Cantu, Army Sergeant in the 1st Cavalry Division, was enlisted in the military, redeployed to Iraq, now one of more than 1,000 active duty soldiers who have signed an appeal for redress that's being presented to Congress next week. And if you've just tuned in, we encourage you to go to our website at democracynow.org, where you can hear that exclusive interview with an active duty soldier in Iraq opposed to the escalation, calling for troops to come home. And we will also link to his pieces, among them Sergeant Cantu's One Soldier's Musings, The Death of a Pro-War Conservative, or The Day I Got Away with Murder. Well, today is also the 5th anniversary of the first prisoners being sent to the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. On January 11, 2002, 20 men in handcuffs, shackles, wearing hoods, arrived at Guantanamo in a plane from Afghanistan. The Bush administration created a new category of enemy combatant for these men captured in the so-called War on Terror. Since then, more than 750 men and boys from 40 countries have been imprisoned at Guantanamo. Not one of them has been put on trial. Hundreds have been released and sent home. Meanwhile, three have committed suicide. At least 40 others have tried to do so. There are concerns about the mental health of most of the 400 or so remaining prisoners. Accounts of prisoner abuse and torture have been condemned around the world. Today, people are coming together across the country and the globe in an international day of action to shut down Guantanamo. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a former Guantanamo detainee who's currently in Cuba as part of an international delegation calling for the closure of the prison camp, as well as the brother of a Guantanamo prisoner who's been held there since 2002. But first, we go back to some of our coverage of Guantanamo over the last 5 years. Democracy Now! Has closely followed the story. We've interviewed former Guantanamo prisoners and interrogators, dozens of attorneys, human rights activists, and more. These are some of the voices. They include Joshua Colangelo Bryan, a lawyer who witnessed his client's suicide attempt during a visit to the camp. Professor Alfred McCoy, author of A Question of Torture. Guantanamo translator Eric Saar, attorney Julia Tarver, and Asmat Beg, whose son Mozam was imprisoned at Guantanamo. But we begin with James Yee, a Muslim chaplain who served at Guantanamo, was later imprisoned himself, though all charges were later dropped against him.
Now, what was Gitmo's secret weapon? Well, from the viewpoint of a chaplain in the United States military, whose role is essentially to advocate for the free exercise of worship, Gitmo's secret weapon was the use of religion against the prisoners, whether to try and break them or frustrate them in the course of trying to glean information from them or in the course of detaining them. Now, how was religion being used against the prisoners? Well, prisoners would come and they would tell me that when they were taken to interrogation, they were, of course, shackled at the wrist and at the waist and at the ankles, as prisoners down in Guantanamo are shackled. And they would tell me that they would be forced to sit in the center of what was painted on the floor, a satanic circle. The interrogators would attempt to force them to bow down and prostrate, you know, like in the form of the Islamic prayer, where Muslims bow down and prostrate. While the interrogator is screaming at that prisoner, that Satan is your God now, not Allah.
One of the things that Donald Rumsfeld did right at the start of the War of Terror, in late 2002, he appointed General Jeffrey Miller to be chief at Guantanamo, all right, because the previous commanders at Guantanamo were too soft on the detainees. And General Miller turned Guantanamo into a de facto behavioral research laboratory, a kind of torture research laboratory. And under General Miller at Guantanamo, they perfected the CIA torture paradigm. They added two key techniques. They went beyond the universal sensory receptors of the original research. They added to it an attack on cultural sensitivity, particularly Arab male sensitivity to issues of gender and sexual identity. And then they went further still. Under General Miller, they created these things called biscuit teams, behavioral science consultation teams. And they actually had qualified military psychologists participating in the ongoing interrogation. And these psychologists would identify individual phobias like fear of dark or attachment to mother. And by the time we're done, by 2003, under General Miller, Guantanamo had perfected the CIA paradigm. And it had a threefold total assault on the human psyche: sensory receptors, self-inflicted pain, cultural sensitivity, and individual fears and phobia.
That day, a technique was used in the interrogation booth where sex was used as a weapon to create a wedge between the detainee we were speaking with and his faith. For example, more specifically, the female interrogator I worked with that day sought to sexually entice the detainee. The logic behind that was that if he would be sexually attracted to her, he would feel unclean, and therefore, she believed in Islam, he would be unable to go back to his cell and pray. One thing she additionally did in order to humiliate him and also to make him feel unclean was wipe what was red ink on his face, but it was done in a way that he believed it was menstrual blood. All of this, again, was in an attempt to create this wedge between himself and his religion, and not only was it ineffective, but I thought it was unethical.
The detainees would tell me things that they experienced in interrogation and what they went through. And one complaint actually caused a lot of turmoil, disturbance, and riots, led to suicide attempts. And that was when an interrogator actually it came back into the camp from a detainee who had been interrogated that his interrogator had actually taken the Quran and kicked it across the floor. Now, this spread throughout the camp and upset the entire population of Muslim prisoners. They protested and led to mass riots and repeated suicide attempts.
The MPs arrived. I left the room. Several minutes later, the MPs came out after having moved Juma into the cell. After a few moments, I decided that I should check and see whether he was finished so that I could come in and speak with him again. I opened the door to the room that houses both the meeting area and the cell. The first thing I saw was a pool of blood on the floor. And strangely, in that first moment, my initial thought was that he had made himself vomit blood, because this is a symptom that he has complained about. And I had the strange thought that maybe he was trying to convince me that it was a genuine symptom and not something that he had made up. A second later, I looked towards the area of the cell, however, and saw Juma hanging by his neck from the top of a mesh metal wall that encloses the cell. He also had what appeared to be a very serious gash on the inside of his right arm, which was causing him to bleed on himself and also on the floor.
The level of hopelessness in the camp has reached a point where our clients are literally vowing they have no other choice but to die. The treatment they're receiving from the guards and the medical staff at Guantanamo is very, very disturbing. What we've learned is that in some sort of ill-advised attempt to stop the hunger strike, the guards and the medical staff are using intervention, medical intervention, to actually inflict forms of torture on our clients. They claim that in order to preserve life at the base, they are inserting tubes into the clients' noses and that go down into their stomachs, and they're able to be fed that way. But the problem is the clients have told us horrific stories repeatedly from different clients about how these same tubes are being forcibly inserted in by riot guards, how they're taken from one detainee and inserted into the next detainee with no sanitization, with the bile and the blood still on the tube from the previous detainee.
They transferred him to Guantanamo Bay. He was badly treated. He was deprived of proper food. He was deprived of natural light, sun, moon, or anything. He said that I haven't seen sun, moon, or sky for the last whole 1 year except for 2 minutes. I'm being treated like an animal. They pulled me and pushed me into cages, and that's how I'm here now. I get, at times I don't get food, and my clothes are torn, they don't care, and I don't know whom to go to.
Asmat Beg, describing a letter from his son Mozam, who was imprisoned for 3 years by U.S. forces at Guantanamo, at Bagram, and at Kandahar. In January 2005, Mozam Beg was released. Our hour-long interview with him is available on our website at democracynow.org. When we come back from break, we're going to Cuba, where we will speak with a former prisoner back in Cuba to protest the Guantanamo prison camp. We'll also speak with the brother of a current detainee. Stay with us.
Nations as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. and prove to me, America, you're aware who's dying for your freedom in this land, who pays the cost for the liberties you demand.
Sarah Thompson, Is It for Freedom? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Protests are scheduled around the world today as part of the International Day to Shut Down Guantanamo. In Washington, D.C., a nonviolent direct action is planned outside the federal court. Protesters dressed in orange jumpsuits and black hoods plan to risk arrest by attempting to deliver motions to the court on behalf of prisoners at Guantanamo. Meanwhile, in Cuba, the first-ever international delegation of former prisoners, families of current prisoners, U.S. lawyers and human rights activists are holding a protest today in front of the gates of Guantanamo. One member of that delegation is Asif Iqbal. He was held at Guantanamo for 2 years. In late 2001, he was taken from Pakistan to Afghanistan, where he was held, beaten, and interrogated by U.S. troops. During his 2 years at Guantanamo, he claims he was abused by U.S. interrogators and forced to make false confessions. He was released in 2004 and has a lawsuit pending against the United States. He joins us now on the phone from Cuba. Asif Iqbal, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
You are a British citizen. You were imprisoned at Guantanamo. You won your release, part of what is known as the Tipton Three, Road to Guantanamo. The film is about you and the other two men you were imprisoned with from Tipton. Why have you returned to the place you were imprisoned for several years?
Well, I'm not going to be exactly at the prison. It's just going to be quite far away, but I've got to do something for the people that are still there. I'm free, but, you know, I can't forget about what happened to me in Guantanamo. For 2.5 years while I was at Guantanamo, people in orange became my family. Even though I'm with my loved ones and my family, they're still there. You know, it's been 5 years since that place was opened. They've had no legal recourse. So, to me, they're all innocent until proven guilty, and I want to make a stand for them.
Earlier in the broadcast, we played a clip of a 10-year-old child named Anas Albana, who called for the release of his father, Jamil Albana, and a family friend who he called Uncle Bashir. That's Bashir Al-Rawi. You knew them at Guantanamo?
Yeah, I knew them in Guantanamo.
They're there now?
I was next. Pardon?
They're there now?
Yeah. And then I remember quite clearly 3 years ago, or just over 3 years ago, when I was next to Jamil Albana, an interrogator came up to Jamil Albana and said, "Don't worry, you'll go home soon." And it's been over 3.5 years since I heard them words from an interrogator. It was said to Jamil. And everyone knows their story. It was basically framed by British officials from an African nation taken to Afghanistan and taken to Guantanamo. Now, they was not in the war zone, but still they ended up in Guantanamo. And the worst thing is, they are still there after such a long time.
I wanted to play for you, Anas Albana, today in Britain, leading the protest calling for the closure of Guantanamo. He's 10 years old.
My dad has been away for 4 years, and it has been a very difficult time for all of us. Is there any justice in this world that can help my dad and also Uncle Bishop? My dad is a human, even though he didn't have a British passport. Where is the human rights?
Anas Albana is 10 years old. He's calling for his father's release at Guantanamo. Asif Iqbal, what are you calling for today as you stand in Cuba, nearby Guantanamo?
I'm calling for torture to be stopped, no matter what the circumstances are, and also for the closure of Guantanamo Bay, and if they don't want to, and for justice to prevail.
Asif, we played a documentary a while ago by a British filmmaker on on what happened at Shebrahan and the voyage of the people, the hundreds, perhaps thousands of people packed into this caravan, what they call the caravan of death. You were one of those people?
Yeah, I was one of them people.
Can you describe what happened? You were one of only a few dozen who survived that journey. Who put you in these trucks, and what happened?
Well, basically, we was put into the containers by Northern Alliance troops, but there was an American presence all the time during this whole horrific event. And basically, we was taken onto truck, off trucks, and put into containers. And when we was in the containers, they basically shot into the containers and killed numerous people, and numerous people suffocated with the lack of oxygen. I was one of the lucky ones that survived it. And even before the shooting, I was unconscious, so I didn't even know that containers got shot at. Then I woke up and I seen all the dead bodies. Then I finally reached my destination. That was Shebrahan.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. We're going to talk to someone who is on the same delegation as you, Taher Deghaez, now. Joining us also on the phone from Cuba, brother of the Guantanamo prisoner Omar Deghaez, formerly a law student in Britain. Omar was arrested in Pakistan along with his family in 2002, taken to Guantanamo, where he's since been held without charge. Taher Deghaez, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Thank you very much for having us.
Tell us why you're there. Tell us about your brother.
Well, the reason we're here is we're trying to draw attention, particularly to the American people, because I think the rest of the world has already heard the message. It's what is here happening in Guantanamo on their name.
Omar, I'm just trying to get a clearer, if you could just speak perhaps a little further from the phone or step, walk a little away from where you are so we can get a clearer phone line.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm here in an office. Okay, go ahead.
Describe again why you were there. Yes, I can hear you.
We're here to draw attention to the plight of these people that have been held here for 5 years. I mean, my brother in particular, 4.5 years, with no trial and no light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, this is not the way we expect a civilized democracy to behave. So we're actually particularly here to draw attention to the American people on what is happening on their name.
Tell us how Omar was taken to Guantanamo. He was arrested in Pakistan along with his family in 2002?
Yeah, he was kidnapped in Pakistan. He was at home with his Afghani wife. He's married a lady from Afghanistan, and they were trying to obtain a visa to come back home to the UK. We were communicating with him, to help him process his visa. One night, apparently, somebody broke into their house, and they took him, they arrested him, or kidnapped him, or depending on which side you're on, and sent his wife back to Afghanistan. Obviously, we did not hear from him for a while, so we were very worried. It all went quiet. We didn't hear from his wife until we received a letter from the Red Cross telling my mom, "Mom, I'm in Guantanamo. Don't worry about me. I'm fine."
Your family are refugees from Libya?
Yes. Omar is a refugee from Libya. We managed to leave Libya in 1986. We seek refuge in the UK. My father was a civil rights warrior in Libya who was killed by Colonel Gaddafi in 1980. And ironically, 27 years later, we are in the same position in the sense that my father never had a trial. He never was convicted of anything. But his ordeal finished in 3 days. Omar's ordeal is continuing. And, it's not a little dictatorship. It's a democracy. It's a country that we've all looked up to, all wanted to have the values, the rights, it's very, very disappointing and disheartening.
Your brother, Omar, has been blinded in one eye at Guantanamo?
Yes, according to the report that we get from his lawyer, because obviously most of the information, I mean, he writes to us, say, we are getting more frequent letters now in the last year, but before we used to hear from him once every 6 months.
Blinded by pepper spray? Blinded by pepper spray?
Yes, apparently. Pepper spray, and apparently they were trying to, restrain him or, something like that.
Tahir, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We're also joined in Washington, D.C. by an attorney who has been to Guantanamo many times. Geeta Gutierrez is with us, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She's gone to Guantanamo to represent prisoners there. CCR and Amnesty International are holding a news conference today on the steps of the Supreme Court to call for the closing of Guantanamo. Geeta Gutierrez, as you hear these voices today in Cuba, as you hear the voices of those who've returned from Guantanamo. Can you talk about the situation of the men who are currently there? How many men are at Guantanamo now, men and boys?
Amy, there's approximately 400, almost 400 men and boys who are still imprisoned at Guantanamo. And the stories that you've heard described of the depression and the grim circumstances there continue. Most of the men are suffering from a deep sense of depression and hopelessness. And the conditions are so restrictive that many of them are not receiving the kind of mental health care that they need.
What is their legal status? How is it that no man has been tried?
Because the Bush administration continues to defy the Supreme Court and has roped Congress into that effort. The government has refused to move forward in federal court with any hearing in any case that men had brought to challenge their detention. So right now, most of them continue to face a sense of indefinite detention with no prospect of a fair hearing.
The military tribunals, what will happen to them? And is there any difference now that Democrats are in charge of the House and the Senate right now?
Well, the military tribunals, the military commissions are military criminal trials that at this point are only applicable to 10 of the nearly 400 men in Guantanamo. So as a practical matter, they're not going to have a large impact on the legal status of most of the men. We expect next week for the military to propose and reveal new rules to govern military commissions that may begin this summer. And we would hope that this time around, Congress will exercise more vigorous oversight for the kinds of rules that are applied there.
The issue of habeas corpus being stripped in the military tribunals bill that was just passed by Democrats as well as Republicans.
Yes, it was. We are hoping that we'll see a decision from the district D.C. Court of Appeals in the next few months or even sooner that addresses the constitutionality of that legislation. And we hope the biggest difference with the Democrats in office now will be that hearings are held on a variety of topics in Guantanamo, on the type of torture and abuse of prisoners, on the accountability for how these policies evolved, and to get some accurate information out to the public and to other government leaders about what's happening in Guantanamo.
Geeta, the former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld described these men at Guantanamo, more than 700 have been held over the last 5 years, as the worst of the worst. Over 300 have been released without trial, without charge. Your response as we wrap up right now, you have 10 seconds.
That's a lie. According to the government's own documents, 92% of the men at Guantanamo are not al-Qaeda fighters, and these are innocent men who deserve to be released immediately.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Geeta Gutierrez, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in Washington, D.C. They're holding a protest on the steps of the Supreme Court today. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Gokuduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Yutz, Anna Nagara, Mike DiFilippo, and Miguel Nagara are engineers. Thanks also to Megan Whitney, Danielle Strandberg, Peshkin, Angela Alston, Yuri Galet, John Randolph, Tayshan Black, Kieran Krug, Meadows. Tonight, we will be in Memphis. I'll be speaking there. You can go to our website at democracynow.org, and there, broadcasting tomorrow and Monday, which is Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, and at the media conference. I'm Amy Goodman. Go to our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.